Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm here today with Jason Wagner, the wine director and co-owner of Fung Tu Restaurant, one that I really, really love. It's a pretty new restaurant down in the Lower East Side meets Chinatown area in Manhattan. Welcome, Jason. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Joe. Good to have you.
So Jason has some real wine cred. Was a sommelier here in New York City at the Atelier de Joe Robuchon, and then moved over to Chicago and put together some pretty impressive lists over there. And now you're back in New York. What brought you back?
Actually, Fung Tu brought me back. Jonathan is a good friend of mine from way long ago, and we were talking about. He was talking to me when he was looking to open the restaurant, and eventually he was like, "Hey, dude, do you want to do this?" And so yeah, it was the perfect reason to come back home.
Now, so you have some other partners here. You have it's Jonathan Wu, it's the chef, John Matthew Wells, Wilson Tang, and you. Why? Okay, so I have two questions. So you met Jonathan Wu in a wine class, right? So tell us about how you all came together. And then why did you not call the restaurant the Wu-Tang Clan? That's been on my mind.
I wish we could call it the Wu-Tang Clan. It's the obvious choice. Well, we were both taking classes with the ASA, infamous American Sommelier Association. And, you know, you'd start the class and you go in there, there's like 40, 50 people. And you're kind of like sitting alone and looking around, who am I going to make friends with here? And Jonathan was sitting nearby. He had a guitar case with him. He was taking guitar lessons after class. And I was like, oh, I play guitar. Like, maybe I'll chat up this guy. And we immediately became friends, study buddies. We would, you know, hang out after class, drink wine, and then hang out during the week and study, hit the books, drink wine, cook food. We just became great friends.
Sounds like a man crush.
Yeah, totally. Totally bromance. Yeah.
I think I might have a little man crush on, because so he's a great chef who worked at Per Se, plays the guitar and knows his wine.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Yeah, to work, especially working with a chef that appreciates wine and knows a lot about it. It really changes the dynamic. He really feels it's an important part of the restaurant, and also like that it enhances the food, and it's not just like shut up and eat my food and wine is ancillary.
Yeah, and also pretty unique for something in the Chinese food kind of sphere. Not that the dishes are, you know, traditional Chinese dishes, I guess, sort of in the way that our dishes are not traditional Italian dishes at Dell'Anima and Lartuzzi, but certainly inspired by that and maybe grouped into that category.
For sure.
You don't see restaurants like that with really good wine lists. Even the few kind of higher end restaurants don't tend to have interesting, well thought out wine lists.
Right, or at least like a focus on it. And yeah, his food definitely has room for it. It's unique food, but it's not weird. And Chinese food in general, I feel like if there's not like a giant spicy element in it, is somewhat on the whole low in acidity, and that leaves a lot of room for wine at the table.
Yeah, and now that's really interesting too, because as a sommelier, I think that something that you are like taught to love very easily is the Riesling and Chinese food pairing. It is the way that you, like, after work can go to like Great New York Noodle Town or one of these late night places and just bring some Riesling, which is undervalued, have some inexpensive food, and that is kind of like one of the ingrained pairings. This is great, but I was surprised and impressed to see on your list that Riesling is not really that present.
Yeah, we have one Riesling on the list. And I'm not going to lie, like, you know, a sweet Mosel Riesling with some Sichuan food is dope. It's awesome. But I feel, especially with Jonathan's food, that there's so much else to play with. We have, you know, a fair amount of Chenin Blanc on the list, which I think is also undervalued price-wise. And also, there's so many styles of it that work nicely with the food. And a lot of light reds. I mean, Beaujolais goes with everything. But also, like, Pinot d'Alanuisse and things like that. Like, a lot of the lighter reds that are no or low tannin, but now, high in acidity.
Now, how do you go about pairing? So I'm used to pairing wines with very high acid foods. Gabe, the chef at our restaurants, really, really loves kind of lots of, like, vinegar and lemon and brightness. Just lots of acid. When you have low acid foods, my instinct is that that's going to open you up to almost a wider range of wines. So you can do low acid wines and high acid wines, or is there something, how do you go about pairing with those foods?
Oh, for sure. I feel like high acidity is nice with that, because you need that kind of refreshing point, but also just like working with a flavor profile. Mm-hmm. When I was putting the list together, you know, I was talking with Jonathan about it, which is awesome because he has a perspective, an informed perspective. And we were looking at what do Chinese people drink with their food. And outside of beer, we came across a Shaosheng rice wine, which is something that was completely unfamiliar to me. So we went to Chinatown, we bought a couple bottles, we tasted it. It was pretty bad. Granted, they weren't like the best examples, but the flavor profile really reminded me of Amontillado sherry. It had mm-hmm. that like nutty, caramelly, salty kind of saline thing. And so that was kind of the jumping off point for putting the list together on the whole, was that, you know, high acidity, but also nutty and saline.
Yeah, that's interesting, and you probably know more about this stuff than I do. So I've cooked with Shaosheng rice wine before. Some recipes from Fuchsia, I don't know if you know Fuchsia Dunlop's book, Every Grain of Rice, killer Chinese cooking book. But are there different? Do you know if there are different grades? Do you guys actually carry the rice wine in the restaurant?
We don't carry any. It's mostly because it's hard to get with the distributors,
right?
They're not like signed up on 750, you know. but we don't. But we do carry, you know, some sherry and stuff like that to kind of fit that whole.
And so, how does that play into Jonathan's food, the kind of nuttiness?
Well, it's a nice counterbalance to some of the stuff. For instance, like we have the bok choy dish, which I think you had. It's like raw bok choy with shrimp paste and. When you pair it with like a Fino sherry, it kind of inspires like that kind of Spanish.
That is like crudité to the next level. I'd so much rather eat your raw bok choy with the shrimp paste, and that is like the best raw vegetable. Is awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of a riff on like crudité or like baña cauda, which you're probably more familiar with. Kind of like the Chinese version of that. It's so good.
Sweet. So now you guys are working on a tasting menu right now. Which wasn't, you know, in play last time I was at the restaurant. Tell us a little bit about that.
We're keeping it simple. We're not doing a giant long one, but we're looking at like six courses, $60, with optional pairings, and trying to keep the pairings like really interesting. So I'm making it a point kind of to not do Riesling, just to open people up to that. And doing sake and sherry and still wines, because bubbly wine is also like an easy go-to, but also awesome. Beer, even. I think I poured for you Rodenbach Grand Cru with the dates.
It's delicious. Yeah. That was just a little bit sour, but not too much, and really, really nice.
Yeah, it's fun to play with those foods, like the dates, because there's like textural components that you can play with as well. And then the sweetness and the savoriness of the dates. And then like you have the sourness and fruitiness of the beer.
How many people are going for the wine pairing?
Well, we haven't totally blasted out on the tasting menu yet. But
also come and be one of the first.
Yeah, exactly. But I do get people that come there and they're like, looking at the wine list and they're like, I don't know what to do, and I'll offer a pairing like on the fly. Yeah.
I feel like when I went, I was very, very fortunate. I feel like I got in on the, you know, and you probably, for other people, you know, in the industry, maybe have done the same thing. I was like, please just choose, you know, choose wines. You guys know the food, obviously, in your wine list much better than I do. And so you poured some wines that I thought paired really well. And I think if I would have chosen my favorite bottle off the list, it wouldn't have been as good as it was having you choose something that was particularly good for each dish. So if I were to go and order the taste menu, I would for sure get your wine pairing.
Thank you. It's fun, and it's for me, I like to do wine pairings because I'm lazy when I go out. I do this all day, you know, like just you choose everything for me, and so I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. I do too. I do too, because you can have, I think, you know, someone like you would put a lot of thought into the wine pairing, what's going to be the best. And you might have a delicious wine that would go great with one of the six dishes, but maybe pretty good with two of the others and not so good with some of the others. And so if you can have kind of an optimal taste and drink experience, that's really nice.
Yeah, I think with pairing wines, the idea is either to get out of the way and don't ruin the food, or to make it better. And in certain situations when you're having many, many different dishes, it's probably better to go with many, many different beverages.
Yeah. One of the other things I really love about your list is that I feel like you really have a point of view. You know, you can have a really good list that has delicious wines, that has stuff for people at every price point, that works well functionally for the people working in the restaurant. You know, customers don't care as much about that part, but but what separates a good list from an excellent list for me is a philosophy and a point of view that's clearly articulated and executed, and having delicious wines to kind of back that up, that are made with integrity. And I feel like you've really accomplished that. Not only do you have are you opening up minds even of industry people that Chinese food and Riesling is not the only pairing, but you also have a lot of very, very natural wines, very handmade wines from small producers. And I feel like I look at your list and I know what you're going for. But if you could articulate a little bit what you're going for, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, well, the focus, you know, outside of the flavor profile is on natural wines. Almost all of them are. But definitely stuff that's first and foremost farmed responsibly. So whether it's organic or biodynamic, I find that to be very important. I have a little boy now, and so people that take care of the earth definitely get my props, because he's going to inherit that one day. And then just minimal intervention in the cellar and little or no sulfur possible. I like that. It's been a learning process to work with smaller and smaller lists, but it's a lot more fun. When I was at Robuchon, we had 800 or so references, and I feel like that was almost easier in a way to work with, where you could just fill holes here and there, and you have this balance of, oh, okay, maybe I want to make the Burgundy list a little bit bigger, so I need Bon Romane, Chablis Chambertin, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas with a smaller list, in a way, you have a little bit more freedom, but every choice has to matter. And then you can edit a little bit better when you're talking with your reps and the distributors. You're like, okay, no, I'm looking for this kind of specific thing and this kind of philosophy behind it. That's kind of where I'm at with it. It's a small list. We're like under 60 bottles. But I feel like everything on there is there for a good reason.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Oh, thanks.
I'm sure
there's people that don't.
No, you know, I really like what you're doing there, and I felt like that I saw some of my favorites, some wines that I had just tasted for the first time and just learned about. Yeah, and then the other ones that I didn't know, I'm like, wow, I'm very curious, and I feel like I should figure out what's going on with that one if I don't know it.
Yeah, it's a fun list, and I'm really have had a chance to like lean on some of the importers that I've developed friendships with over the years, and they've brought me like super cool stuff, even offering it to me exclusively or that sort of thing, which is really cool. I mean, we wouldn't be able to do anything interesting if it weren't for really awesome importers.
That's true. All right, so we are going to take a very quick break. We'll be back with more with Jason Wagner from Funk 2 on In the Drink.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
We're back with Jason Wagner on In the Drink from Funk 2 Restaurant. Jason, I want to ask you about the neighborhood where you are. It's kind of Lower East Side meets Chinatown. When you were putting the list together, were you also thinking about the neighborhood, what people were drinking kind of in that part of the city? And why did you guys choose that area for the restaurant?
Sure. We chose the location, partially because Wilson Tang, who's the owner of No Moi, he's a longtime Chinatown resident, like grew up there, and has a lot of connections in the neighborhood. So when Jonathan was looking for the space with him, came up, and we were kind of like, oh, this is perfect. It's almost in Chinatown. It's barely in the Lower East Side, and it seemed to make sense with what we were doing. Restaurant-wise, being Chinese, obviously Chinatown makes sense. And, you know, the fact that we're doing like a modern take on it and having a beverage program made sense for the Lower East Side. The list, you know, I worked in Midtown before, and Lower East Side is a very different dining destination than Midtown. So I needed to make it more price conscious as far as, you know, having the marquee bottles. You know, there's no Mayo Camisée on the list as much as I love it. So I definitely wanted to have a price point that was a lot more approachable, and then have a couple little guys that if it's a special night, you can have a special bottle. But everything is about $120 and below, with a big focus in the $60 range, which is, it's kind of like a list of a restaurant that I would go to.
Yeah.
Like I can't afford to buy Marquis de Liguiche and Mouton Rothschild and stuff like that. But I wanted it to be a neighborhood kind of a list where you can go and you can discover something and have something at a price point where you're like, oh, I can go there like once a week, twice a week, and drink a totally dope bottle of wine or glass of wine. And not kill the bank.
Now, are there some you know, with such a well-edited list, do you find yourself trying to have all different producers, or are there some producers that you'll have multiple bottles from? Are there some kind of core producers to your list?
There are some core producers, and I'm not against doubling up on producers. I try not to do it too much, but I really love René Moss. I have always tried to carry a white specifically by René Moss, which is so, so delicious. I really love Robineau in the Loire Valley. I think I poured his Pinot d'Anis for mm-hmm. you. I think his reds are fantastic. And then outside of that, I try to, you know, just find the next deliciousness and keep things moving. That's kind of the nice thing about a smaller list, is that it can be very nimble you can run through stock on something and, okay, all right, what else is out there? Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the Rémy Moss Pétillant Naturel wines.
Oh, yeah.
And had not had the Still White until you poured it for me, and I was blown away.
That's so good.
It was so good. That wine was absolutely, absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it's a lot of everything. It's a lot of minerality. It's a lot of fruit. It's not a lot of oak, but a lot of everything else.
Now, you kind of just got through the review period.
Yeah.
How did that go? I think that's like the worst time in a restaurant's life.
It's totally the worst. It's exhausting. And you know, for your first 3 months or 4 months, every table, every guest is under the radar. You know, you're looking at pictures, trying to recognize reviewers. And at the end of the day, does that even make a difference? It's tough. And it's especially tough right off the bat when, you know, you have somebody come in your first week when you're still trying to figure out flow of service and all of that. And then they write you up and then trash you. It's really, really disheartening in some sense, but it also gives you an extra push, you know, an extra drive. Mm-hmm. There's nothing quite like going through that period.
Did you have the moment, you know, when you got a bad review, or it was like, you don't understand, like, I've been friends with him for 10 years. I moved here from Chicago. I've been busting my ass and I have a baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't understand. This is
there's a couple moments like that where I think when I was just like, wow, they just don't get it. Like, I think especially the first few people that came through were like, oh, cool, this is going to be like Mission Chinese. And it's not. And when it was like that, they just didn't get what we were trying to do.
It's almost the opposite of Mission Chinese in a way. I mean, not only is the food not like super, super spicy, but, you know, the definitely emphasis on the service and the wine program and kind of a really, like, I think, relaxed, nice dining experience, but still with, like, being on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, it's a little quieter and just a little brighter, you know.
I love me some Mission Chinese.
But no doubt,
aggressive.
Yeah, for sure. And there's totally a place for that. But I think when the first set of reviewers came through, they were kind of hoping that's what we were. And when we weren't that, they were not into it.
And what's the deal with the reviewers kind of ignoring the emphasis on the wine program?
Yeah, it's a little puzzling. I think we were talking about the Jordan McKay piece in Punch about that. I know it's definitely hard for them budget wise and whatnot, but it's a weird thing. I think it's a part of the whole entire restaurant experience, and to ignore it, it's kind of doing a disservice to the reader, because most of our patrons come and drink with their dinner. Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be nice to have someone kind of like reviewing, like Talia used to do. She used to review wine lists, and I think that was a great service to the people that read. Because there's a lot of people that do consider the beverage a really important part of their dining experience.
And for a restaurant to make that conscious decision that we're going to invest in a wine program, it's, you know, it's storage, it's inventory, it's training of the staff, it's meeting with reps, there's
a
lot salary. Of work, it's
yeah.
a salary, yeah. It's a lot of work, and it's a big, yeah. it's just a big emphasis. And for, you know, the difference between a restaurant that focuses on a wine program and invests in it and one that doesn't, I think, is the one that invests in it really is on that guest side, is trying to offer a guest a much more special experience than the one that doesn't. And it just blows my mind that that reviewers spend so little of their real estate paying attention to it.
Yeah, I get it in some sense, but I do think, you know, it would be a service to the readers if they would at least spend a little bit. You know, almost all of our reviews just had like a one line kind of thing at the bottom. It was like, drink a, you know, $12 wine by the glass. Which is not, you know, the experience that you can really have, as you can attest to at Fung Tu.
Yeah, for me it was, and I love the food, but it was just as much about the wine there. Maybe even for me a little bit more because of
I'm a
wine guy. But I think, you know, it was such a more fun time because we were tasting all these really delicious wines.
Yeah, and not to take anything away from the food at all.
Absolutely. And I came back, you know, can drink really good wine in a couple of different places, but that I came back because the food's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Now, where do you like to drink wine around the city?
Mostly at home right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, Tin Bells is right around the corner, so that's a pretty great place to go and jazz on some natural wine. And I was going to went to Contra right when they opened, and Linda put together a really cool, really fun list. We drank a lot of great wine there.
Also focus on more natural wine. Exactly. Where did your interest in natural wine start?
It's hard to pinpoint. It hasn't always been something that I was really into, but I used to live in Williamsburg many moons ago and would shop at Uva. And Uva had a great selection of natural wines. And I think I actually got into it by just loving the wines first and then like finding out what they're about later. That's kind of it. And then I took a trip 2 years ago to the Loire Valley with the Dresdner team and went to the Dives Bouteilles and visited a lot of their growers. And that's really, it really had a profound impact on my viewpoint. Especially viticulturally, that it's important to take care of the earth and spraying chemicals and that sort of thing is just a bad thing. It's not what I want to put in my body.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that stuff. But I just was part of a panel discussion with Clark Smith, who wrote a book called Postmodern Wine. It was really interesting. And one of Clark's main point of views was that natural producers will tell you that they are producing in a very natural way, but a lot of times it's very misleading, and there's mm-hmm. stuff that is not being disclosed sure. to you and me. He's someone who has a lot of experience in the industry, and I think sometimes has a pessimistic view, and maybe we can be, or I can personally be a little too optimistic when it comes to trusting our trusted importers and
sure.
Growers. But were you to know everything that goes on in the life cycle of the wine, where do you kind of draw the line? What is something that, you know, it puts it no longer into natural wine for you and then puts it into this other realm of wine that is more messed around with and more not acceptable to your taste?
I think the yeast issue is up there. Using indigenous yeast, there's, you know, a lot of discussion, is indigenous yeast really indigenous and all of that. But I think just adding yeast, adding sulfur, I understand like why you need to add sulfur to stuff, having many, many bottles oxidize on me and stuff like that. But I think for me, if I had to put a definition on natural wine, it would be about yeast and sulfur.
Yeah. It seems like a really violent process. If you think about if you can buy into that wine is a living and evolving thing, that you were to add the sulfur to a wine before it's fermented and kill off its entire native yeast population so that you can then add a white powder that you got that was produced in the laboratory somewhere to that so that it acts the way that you want it to. I also, that certainly rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, it just doesn't. It doesn't feel right. It's kind of icky.
it's kind of icky. Yeah. But there's obviously there's so many even I think worse and ickier things that people can do to wine.
There are a lot worse things that you can do. That's for sure.
Well, you're not going to find them at Fung Tu, but you will find me drinking there sometimes. I just wanted to thank you, Jason, so much for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure to have you.
Joe, it's always a blast seeing you.
The New York City sommelier community and now restaurant community is in better shape now that you're back here in the city. So I appreciate it. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
And before we go, I wanted to leave you guys off with next week on May 7th. We're going to be having a very special winemaker dinner at Lartuzzi with the very natural wines of Emidio Pepe.
Nice.
We're going to have three generations of Pepes there. The founder, Emidio, he's in the city to celebrate his 50th anniversary. His daughter, Sofia Pepe, who is currently the winemaker, and his granddaughter, Chiara, who is pretty much like the global ambassador for these wines, but she's still in school and she's been on the show talking about them. So you can archive the Chiara Pepe. She's like 20 years old, but she's like one of the most articulate people and enthusiastic people in the wine industry. She can school you on like Bartolo Mascarello vintages. She's 20. It's absurd. No, she might be 21 now. It's crazy. Anyway, it's a very special dinner. All three of them will be in the private dining room at Lartuzzi. There's only like 13 seats in total. So three of them will be those. And hopefully you guys can be one of the other lucky 10. So you can go to Lartuzzi's website or the Eventbrite. If you Google Eventbrite and Lartuzzi upcoming winemaker dinners, you'll be able to find that. Hope to see you there. We will be pouring wines from the 70s, 80s, and 2000s. And I've been trying to convince Chiara to smuggle back a bottle of their Cerasuolo for me. Have you had the Cerasuolo?
I have not, but that sounds awesome.
It is not imported. And when I was out there, I was telling Emidio about how much I love his Cerasuolo. And please, can you please import some, at least just for us? And he's like, I'm really not that into it. He's like, he only wants to export the very aged wines. So Montepulciano that's like at least seen like 10 years of age, and Trebbiano that's at least seen 5-6 years of age. But Cerasuolo, something for the Italian market. Wacky. So hopefully they're going to smuggle some back. All right. That's all the time we have today. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.